Good morning, everyone. Boker Tov. Welcome to Sunday Shul at Emmanuel. This is the course, The Chronicles of the Messiah. We are doing class 155 of the Chronicles. Class 155 will mainly be this morning in Luke 23 and John 18. Those will be the primary text where we'll be, where we're situated in the Chronicles is the Passion. The Passion of Jesus. We've gone through the trial both from his time at, before Annas and why Jesus reacted the way he did with Annas, how he was transferred to Caiaphas's court, and what happened there, and then how he was transferred out of Caiaphas's court. And today we'll see the third venue of his trial, and that is before Pontius Pilate. So we'll talk a little bit about Pilate, who he was as a man. We've done some of that previously in the Chronicles, but we'll review some of that. And kind of interspersed between all of that drama of the trial was Peter's denials, his three denials before the rooster crowed. And of course, we know it wasn't a rooster. It was the call to Shacharit, the call to a morning prayer, morning sacrifice. And then also kind of running parallel stream with Peter was Judas and Judas's response. And so we kind of left it with a cliffhanger in the sense that we had two disciples, two on the inner circle of Jesus, both become disloyal to him, both betray him, both lose connection with him. And that was important to include in the Gospels because the early communities that were reading these Gospels and hearing these Gospels as the first hearers were those who were being persecuted by Rome and by other communities, and many of them had caved in and in order to preserve their business or their family or even their lives, they denied or disavowed a relationship to the Messiah. And so they had a question, obviously, of their own spiritual torment. Can I find my way back? Can I find my way back? And so we're going to see with... We saw the end result of Judas. We talked about it last week. We haven't got to Peter's, can he find his way back, that will give us the answer. Can we find our way back when we disconnect? That'll be coming soon. So that was kind of interwoven in the trials. Okay, so that's where we're picking it up today. So let's begin with prayer. Blessed Lord, since you have caused all Holy Scriptures to be written for our learning, grant that we may so hear them, read, mark, learn, and inwardly digest them, that by patience and comfort of your holy word, we would embrace and ever hold fast the blessed hope of everlasting life. We pray these things through Jesus Christ, your Son, our Lord, who lives and reigns with you in the Holy Spirit, one God, now and forever. Amen. All right, so a change of venue. Luke 23, beginning in the first verse there. The entire assembly rose up and led him, that is our Messiah Jesus, to Pilatus, to Pilate. So this is early in the morning on the eve of Passover. All right, this is where we're at on a chronological timeline. The council that had gathered with Caiaphas, which we have established was not the legitimate Sanhedrin, we know from sources like Josephus, the Talmud, and some other sources that at the time of Caiaphas' high priesthood, Rome had scattered the Sanhedrin, exiled them. They weren't allowed to meet on the Temple Mount anymore, and geographically they were scattered. So the idea that they could be all of them assembled on kind of a snap of a finger in the middle of the night was just a geographic impossibility. So we established probably what that court was made up of. It was probably made up of an inner sanctum of the Sadducean priesthood. Okay, so whatever that council was that was with Caiaphas, that reached decision when Caiaphas tore his garment, which we've spoken about and so forth, they were discussing the next steps that they have to take. So Annas, Caiaphas, the colleagues knew that whatever it was going to be had to be very quickly and discreet. So they turned the prisoner over to the Roman legal system. And the timing of this was very critical. The reason it's critical is because you're at the eve of Passover. Passover is one of the three pilgrimage festivals, right? So it's kind of like three times a year, the city of Jerusalem is going to swell with Jewish people from all over the world. This already makes Rome nervous. And especially at Passover with its theme of redemption and liberation and God's people overcoming a foreign oppressor, that kind of theme, it's a holiday that's ripe for nationalism, right? It would be like if someone were to have taken over the United States of America, 4th of July would probably be a holiday that they would assume we would best be forgetting, right? Because we would might be filled with dreams of the past when we were proud and when we defeated our enemies and when we were brave. And so Rome doesn't like it. The priesthood doesn't like it either, because if the people start acting up, who does Rome take it out on? It takes it out on the Temple Mount and the priesthood, right? And so there's a need to kind of maintain a status quo, a balance. And so timing is of critical importance as people are packing into the city, making preparations for their seders. They knew that the news of what was going on would spread quickly. So many in the crowds that would have been there would have loved Jesus. They would have been followers of him, whether they had fully accepted him as the Messiah, the Son of God yet or not. Many of them would have. Many of them would have at least heard him, seen him, encountered him in the Galilee, and at least had a favorable impression of him, at least seen him as a prophet or someone anointed of God, clearly someone that they would not have want to be see die or be given unfair treatment. In these short hours, all of these people would be all in the city, so they had to handle this quickly. If they waited until the day to approach Pilate, they might miss the opportunity in order to have his execution that same day. And that would force them to keep Jesus in custody over the holiday and over the Sabbath. All right, because this is one of the years where Passover is actually falling on a Sabbath. And so if they ended up keeping him over the weekend, not only would it allow time for supporters to rally the troops, so to speak, but also the fervor of it might also die down as far as the impetus to deal with him. All right, things tend to cool down over time. So they briefly discuss the types of charges that they might lodge against Jesus, and then they send a delegation of priests and dignitaries to walk him across the city. The small party of priests and members of Caiaphas' party, again, you can kind of imagine it's going to be early morning, so you can just kind of imagine them walking through the cool streets and the back alleyways when it's, even now, if you live in a big city, there's that rare part of, certain part of the morning where it's calm. Right, where before the traffic hits, before rush hour hits, where it's still a little cool in the air, a little defrost has to come on in your car. So they're moving through the streets kind of in this time of day. They would have been taking Jesus with them. He would have been bound with his hands, and he probably would have already been showing bruising based upon that cruel game we talked about that Josephus recorded that was common among the prisoners and the guards. Not many people would have been moving out yet, so it was a perfect time for them to deliver Jesus to the Romans. Caiaphas does not accompany the party. He had matters to conduct in the temple that day. That day was Erev Pesach, all right, the eve of Passover. That was the day of the Passover sacrifices, and so he needed to be there and be on duty that afternoon. Right, so he had a job to do, so to speak. So let's look a little bit at Pilate. Slip over to John 18. John 18, verse 29. John chapter 18, verse 29. There it describes Pilate coming out to them and saying, "Why are you condemning this man?" Now, let's get our wits about Pilate. Who was Pilate? Tiberius Caesar had appointed Pontius Pilate to be prefect over Judea around 26 of the common era in our calendar. You do realize the Western world has had at least three calendars since Jesus, all right? So it's always tricky, but going from our current calendar system, probably around 26, Pilate is appointed prefect over the Judean region, okay? So this is how Rome worked. It liked to take over large masses of land, but then it liked to assure the people that it was overtaking, don't worry, we're not going to mess with anything in your life. All we want is your tax money, right? You pay us taxes, everything's good. You get to continue to worship the gods you worship. You get to continue to have the temples you have, holidays you have. You can even still have your rulers and your local governors and your townships. None of that changes. Well, except for they better agree with what we tell them to do. And again, they better pay lots of taxes. So it was trying to coax the hoi polloi, the masses, into thinking, oh, it's not so bad having Rome over us. They really don't mess with us. I mean, I still go to my job every day. I still live in the same town. And Peter's still mayor, right? Well, Peter's life's changed dramatically, but Peter's still mayor, right? But you have higher taxes. Right, and so to ensure that that system worked well, Rome would appoint prefects, governors, magistrates, you know, depending on how many people you had under you, to rule certain regions and to make sure taxes were collected, numero uno, and that the most of the masses were kind of good with a slave mentality. If you've been in Torah Tuesday, we've been talking about that, where you have a slave mentality and you don't even know it. You just think, well, this is normal. You know, I still can get married to the girl of my dreams. I can still have my two kids and white picket fence, sort of. It's okay, right? And then if there were any people who started getting bright ideas about breaking that status quo, the prefect needed to deal with them with the Roman military. And so Pilate was given the area of Judea, which is a geographic region, okay? It's not all of Israel, it's not all of the Promised Land, but it's the part that has Jerusalem in it, all right? He was given Judea. Pilate came up from what's known in Roman nobility as the equestrian rank. He came from the equestrian rank, which was Roman nobility, but lower Roman nobility. So here's the thing when you have class systems, right? It's not just lower, middle, upper, right? There's always lower, middle, 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 upper, middle, lower, upper, right? So he's nobility. He comes from nobility genes. He comes from officers and all of that, but a lower ranking nobility, which probably will give him somewhat of a complex. He's going to want to prove himself and raise his class up to middle nobility, okay? But he comes from the equestrian rank. He had distinguished service in the military. Rome did have pretty good historians, so we do know some of these things. Shy of previous 1960 when they like to pretend Pontius Pilate didn't exist. Since then, things have shown up that proved he did exist, and we've learned about Pontius Pilate. The name Pontius, is really not his name, right? It was not, hey, Pont, how's it going? Or, I'm Pontius. It is a title, and it refers to his tribe, right? And the Jewish people aren't the only ones with tribes. Rome had them as well. Comes from the Pontii tribe, an ancient Samnite tribe. The name Pilatus, Pilate, derives from Pileus, which in Latin means helmet, or it could be also derived from Pilum, which means javelin. But both are from that kind of legion, part of the military, helmet, javelin. He clearly was serving in this equestrian rank of the military where he would have had these kinds of tools for warfare. So Pontius Pilate isn't his name. That's what he's known in history as, but that's not his real name. I don't know his real name. Hopefully one day we'll figure that out. It'll probably be something common like Jack or something. I don't know. But Pontius Pilate, again, is describing where he's from, what tribe he is, which is important when you've got things like nobility classes and all that, right? I'm a Worthington or I'm a Kennedy, right? It, you know, most Kennedy women, when they get married, what do they still keep in their name? They still keep Kennedy in their name. Why? Because it matters, right? Yeah. I'm so-and-so Kennedy Smith. Oh, Kennedy, did you say Kennedy? Are you one of the Kennedys? Yes. So keeping that in his name, and then the other is kind of his title. All right. 1961, archaeologists discovered an inscription bearing Pilate's name. Before that, there were critics and skeptics of the Bible that like to say the New Testament didn't know what it's talking about. There was never a dude named Pilate, much less ruler of Judea. Surely if there was a ruler of the Judean region in the first century, there would be some kind of evidence of it. Lo and behold, there is. In Caesarea Maritime, they uncovered a limestone dedication plaque that was used originally on the street. So Pilate would have had this street made at Caesarea, named in honor of Caesar. And where the archaeologists found it was in the amphitheater at Caesarea as a seat. Right? So they repurposed some stuff. So when earthquakes strike, it's very hard to go mining again and rebuild an entire city. So what do you tend to use? That looks like that would replace that bench over there, right? Well, let's use it. So that's actually where they discovered it, was as a replacement after an earthquake, a replacement for a seat in the amphitheater. The Latin inscription that once would have adorned either a seat or a place in the street or possibly a cornerstone of a building said that this place was named for Tiberium, that is Tiberius Caesar. That's why it's called Caesarea. And it was constructed or possibly restored, but somehow Pilate was behind the project. Okay, possible English reconstruction of the Latin simply reads Tiberius Caesar by order of Pontius Pilate, prefect of Judah, here dedicates, and then the stone breaks off. So Pontius Pilate was involved in that. As a prefect, Pilate had military and judicial jurisdiction over the province of Judea. So it wasn't just military and it wasn't just judicial. He had both. He had the military at his hand, but he also had the right to make judicial courtroom decisions. He also conducted the collection, or he oversaw the collection of the Roman taxes in the area. His predecessor was a man named Valerius. Pilate controlled, Valerius is the one who instituted the concept of, well, the Jewish people have this concept where they have a priesthood, you know, from a Roman perspective, and they have this way of, deciding who their priest is. Well, Rome wants the masses to think that you still have a priesthood and that you still have a temple and that you're still having sacrifices. But Valerius said, you know what, I'm going to personally appoint your high priest. All right. So what do you think starts happening with that system? Right? Okay. And Pilate continues to do this. He continues to be the one who appoints the high priesthood. And so throughout his entire tenure over Judea, which is quite an extensive period of time, Pilate only has one high priest. He appoints one high priest and he stays high priest the entire time Pilate is high priest, and that's Caiaphas. The predecessors of Pilate, the Roman governors that followed him, had a new priest at least once a year, if not more. So when you look at his predecessor and those who came after him, his successors, they were changing priests left and right. Pilate keeps one and only one priest for a very long period of time. What might that lead us to conclude about their relationship? All right. We don't know it for sure. We're just saying it does give us pause to think. Maybe they had a partnership, right? All right. And that's why one stayed so long. The fact that Caiaphas held the priesthood throughout the administration and he lost it the second Pilate was gone indicates probably they had a close and mutually beneficial relationship. It was mutually. There was something mutual in it. Pilate would ordinarily not stay in Jerusalem. He would not want to stay in Jerusalem. He's a Roman. And he's not going to want to stay in the Jewish capital where Jewish presence is thick and it's the heart of their religion. He's not going to want that. That's not going to be his cup of tea. He's going to want to stay in Caesarea, which was the Roman capital of the region. Caesarea, if you've ever been blessed to have been there, is gorgeous. It's on the Mediterranean. Soft sand, white beaches, and the place in Caesarea where he stays who's also, will become where the Apostle Paul is held as house prisoner, right? That's kind of where if the Roman Emperor were to come visit, that's his place. And so obviously the Roman Emperor isn't going to be there very often. So that's where the prefect would stay. It had, even in the first century, indoor heated swimming pools, fresh water, indoor heated swimming pools in the first century. All right. As well as being just overlooking the gorgeous sea, the nice cool air, hippodrome where you could watch the chariot races just over the corner there. It was just the best place in the world to be. All right. That's where Pilate's going to want to be. All right. Because the Jews that did live there at that time very much had compromised and were like, Rome is good. Right. Because they're living in the city where the prefect lives. So that city's awesome. Right? It's got everything. It's got the amphitheater, the hippodrome. It's the place to be. It's New York City. And so that's where Pilate's going to be comfortable. So that's where he normally stays, except during the pilgrimage festivals, because as we discussed, that's when things are a little tense there. So he needs to be there to make sure things are handled. The time when the passion is occurring, Pilate is in about his fourth year of being the prefect. So he's not a rookie, but he's not a veteran. He's in his fourth year of service. But he's already established a pretty nasty reputation in those 4 years among those in Jerusalem. He had already kind of borrowed from the temple treasurer, right? And that's where you gotta think, if Caiaphas stayed during this long tenure, there's probably some mutuality there. But he takes money from the temple treasury. He also subdued protesters by having them clubbed to death. I think I shared that earlier in the Chronicles where a bunch of Jews were protesting. So Pilate says this, I, Pilate, am a Roman, and as a Roman, I tolerate everybody, right? Which usually means I tolerate no one unless you agree with me. But the guise of tolerance, the way it is now, is the way it worked then too. I am a Roman, I tolerate everybody, and I care about everybody, and I want to hear everybody's grievances. So tomorrow morning, please show up, and I will listen to you. And then he has a bunch of his Roman soldiers dress up like Jewish people, look like the Jewish people that are going to be showing up the next morning that have been in this mob. And they all show up, and Pilate then kind of gives a signal, and then all his men dressed like fellow Jews start beating to death all the Jews that had gathered. Right? And that was Pilate's way of saying, don't bother me, right? So he'd already done something like that, okay? He had already tried to put his insignia on the temple, all right, and throughout Jerusalem, replacing symbols of the tribes and different things with his symbol. So he's already done all these kinds of things. So he's already got this kind of contentious relationship with Israel, I mean with Jerusalem. Now, there are some traditions in the early Christian church that try to depict Pilate as an innocent player who attempted to defend Jesus. Now, why do you think around the 3rd or 4th century Christians would start developing a tradition that Pilate was really a good guy and it was the Jews who forced him into this difficult situation? Who's persecuting the Christians? Who's persecuting Jesus followers? Rome! So let's make Jesus followers look Rome friendly. It was really the Jews that did it. Pilate was a good guy. We like Rome. We like you guys. We can exist in your empire and Jesus, he's just like Apollo. That's what Justin would argue. And he'd start, doing things like that. Hellenizing things. Oh, Pilate, what could he do? Look what the Jews did to him. They backed him into a corner. He had no choice. He was just this innocent victim, right? And so some traditions depict Pilate even as a hero, a secret believer even, that both Pilate and some small communities, Pilate and his wife were even canonized as saints. Why are you persecuting us, Rome? One of our saints is Saint Pilate, Saint Pontius Pilate. Look, we have a mosaic of him on the floor of our church. The real Pontius Pilate was not worthy of this, okay? He may not have been totally just the sole villain in the trial of Jesus, but he doesn't emerge as a heroic defender of justice either, okay? The Gospels at best depict him as a disinterested Roman overlord who was willing to commit a travesty of justice to maintain political stability, right? So, I mean, that's at the very least. That's at the very least, as he's depicted. So, just be aware of some of those early traditions in the 3rd century and why they might have started existing in that point. You know, when you're being fed to the lions by that particular empire, you want to prove that you're friendly to that empire. Okay. The Praetorium, John 18, verse 28. Early in the morning, they led Yeshua, Jesus, from the house of Caiaphas, to the hall of justice. So they lead Jesus to the Praetorium. The word Praetorium refers to the residence of the Roman governor while in Jerusalem. When praetors began to function as governors over Roman conquests, they would take up residence in the main city, typically the palace of the former king the Romans replaced. Okay? That way it's kind of a reminder that in case you get too much of a nationalistic zealot about you, we're living in your former president. We're living in the White House, right? I mean, that would be a powerful image if all of a sudden someone moved into the White House, right, and did a press conference from the Oval Office. The symbolism alone of that would be enough to deject most people. Okay? So that's what they would commonly do. So be aware of when former holy sites, even if they are holy to things like money, power, and materialism, when they're destroyed and a religious institution's built on top of it, don't overlook that fact. It's not just because they happen to get a good deal in Manhattan. It's a statement. It's a statement of that which you trusted in, we are now parked on. Right? It's a very powerful statement. And Rome also did that. The Roman governor of Judea, as I said, though, would not normally reside in the Praetorium. Only during things like Passover, Sukkot, the pilgrimage festivals. Normally would be in Caesarea, the Roman capital of the province, and there at that lavish seaside estate that Herod the Great had constructed. The book of Acts refers to this area as Herod's Praetorium. On certain occasions, however, business required the Roman governor to be here. The large crowds that gathered in Jerusalem for the festivals, many came to kind of incite and create insurrection, heighten security and the need for this. So while administrating from Jerusalem, the governor would have occupied this large, and it was a 3-towered palace of King Herod the Great. All right? King Herod the Great had this constructed. It sat atop the western hill in Jerusalem's upper city. On the western hill in Jerusalem's upper city. At that location, King Herod had built 3 enormous towers in order to fortify a weak point in Jerusalem's walls. He constructed the towers out of huge interlocking pieces of limestone. It's quite a sight to see. Herod named one of the towers after his friend Hippicus. Maybe that's where we get the hiccup from, I don't know. But he named it after his friend Hippicus. He named one tower after his brother Phaziel. And the 3rd tower after his Hasmonean wife Miriam. Right? Remember, Herod desperately wanted to be what? King of the Jews. Problem being, he no Jew. So what does Herod do? Well, first he's Herod, so he tries to find anybody that's from the line of David and kill them. That's why they left Bethlehem of Judea down south and scattered all the way up to the Galilee, hiding from Herod. And they kind of scattered around. Lots of history about that. But then after he kind of either kills Davidic people or scares them into where they don't report that they're Davidic people, he then has to get some Jewish bloodline in them. So he marries a Hasmonean. Well, who are the Hasmoneans? They're not just Jews, right? You want to talk Jewish royalty, Jewish nobility? Who are the Hasmoneans? That goes back to Hanukkah fame, right? These are the people that freed us from the Greeks. right? And the whole miracle of the oil and all that. So he's marrying in, you know, he's marrying into Jewish royalty here. So he's hoping that over time people will just assume, well, he's married to Hasmonean, and he too must be Jewish, right? Right? But his children will be Jewish halakhically, and that's part of his plan too. All right. So he names one of them after his Hasmonean wife, and he built the tower Hippicus Square, 80 cubits high. He modeled the tower of Phaziel after the lighthouse of Pharos in Alexandria. It stood 90 cubits high and contained a palace complete with a bathhouse. Herod always had a bathhouse, always had fresh heated pools. The smaller tower, Miriam, had the most magnificent adornments and had lavish upper story, had three stories. We're getting this stuff from Josephus, by the way. Josephus explains that the three towers appeared even taller than their actual height because Herod had them built at the highest point of the upper city. Right, so you build a tall building on the tallest hill, it looks even taller, right? Josephus writes this: they appeared much taller because of the location in which they stood. The old section of a wall within which they stood was built on a high hill and was itself a kind of height some 30 cubits higher. The towers stood over top the location and thereby appeared much higher to the people. Okay, that's architecturally intentional, right? You want imposing architecture. The eminence of the palace and the tower explains why the Gospel of John says the place bore the Hebrew name Gabbatha, which in the Aramaic, Gabbatha, means the height. The foundations of one of those towers can still be seen to this day, just inside the Jaffa Gate. It is known popularly today as David's Citadel, right? So again, if you've been blessed to be to the holy city of Jerusalem, and you've seen David's Citadel, you're now seeing one of Herod's part of his praetorium. Okay. The palace consisted of two primary living quarters, each one very extravagant. So this is where Pilate is. This is where they're going to bring Jesus. Pilate is enjoying the delights, the amenities of the palace. He once attempted to adorn the palace with golden shields bearing his name, with an inscription that said, to the honor of Tiberius Caesar, the current Caesar. So that's a way an egotistical person still plays politics. Caesar can crush him, but Pilate wants everyone to know that he's the man in Jerusalem. So he puts gigantic propaganda things that basically say, I'm the man, his shield. But then at the bottom, he's like, to the praise and glory of Caesar Tiberius, right? So really, it's really all for the praise of Caesar. So that if Caesar gets wind that he's plastering essentially billboards of himself all over town, they'll at least say at the bottom, well, this is really all because of Caesar, right? So he's trying to make it be okay with Caesar, but push himself on the people as their authority. However, Herod Antipas, a descendant of Herod the Great, who had claims by inheritance to this place, didn't like Pilate's name being all over his house. Okay? So Herod Antipas and Pilate have to live in kind of rival quarters, and they don't really like each other a whole lot, until certain someone brings them together. Okay? So this Herod complains to Caesar, and Caesar then says, look, take down your shields and your billboards of yourself and so forth. All right, so that's a little bit about Pilate, where he's at, a little bit of maybe who he is, his mindset. Again, the Gospels mainly portray him not just like pure evil incarnate, but more like totally disinterested in the welfare of the Jewish people, could care less about the Jewish people, certainly could care less about this whole Messiah theme, but knows the situation at Passover, so he's willing to commit mass injustice just to get this thing done. All right? That's how he's portrayed, which is its own branch of evil, no less. Okay? So the tribunal. On the stone-paved open-air courtyard outside of the palace, the Roman governor raised a platform called a tribunal. The Greek New Testament calls it the Bema. That's the Greek word. So now you know if you call it bima or bima seat, you're using Greek, not Hebrew, just so you know. The governor ascended a flight of steps to access the top of the platform where he'd have sat on a judgment bench. So he's going to hold court, open air court. No doubt some people in the crowd were probably thinking, don't really want to show up because remember last time we showed up, he had court. All these people that were dressed like us started beating tar out of us, right? Okay. But he sits and he has tribunal the day before the annual Passover festival. Okay, so every year on Passover Eve, Erev Pesach, to earn the goodwill of the people, of course, and to help diffuse tensions that might trigger riots, but in reality, it's no different than what politicians do today. It's to kind of numb the masses, the people who don't really think about things and just kind of see something flashing, go, oh, our government's not corrupt. Look at that. Look at that beautiful thing they just did. They just had a beautiful memorial service. Of course, they had nothing to do with that. It was a beautiful memorial service, right? So Pilate does this once a year for the previous 3 years to say, look, I'm Roman. I tolerate everybody. I care about you. I care about everybody because I'm Roman. Please tell me what I can do as a gesture of goodwill for your people on this, your holy day, right? That is, I'm the president. I'm not Jewish, but I'm going to have a Passover Seder at the White House on Passover, right? So that I can placate some people that don't really think about things into thinking, oh, he loves Jewish people. He loves Israel. He just had a Passover Seder at the White House. Right. Okay, that's what Pilate's doing. All right? And he's wanting to defuse the triggering of riots. So he honors at the Festival of Freedom, Passover, the Festival of Redemption. He pardons and releases a single prisoner. Now, Pilate expected that those who had sons or brothers or husbands or who had been arrested for political activism or terrorism to gather that day and petition for the release of their man, right? They're asking for a he's given a presidential pardon. So he expected there'd be different groups, family members and so forth of various political prisoners, you know, like Jonathan Pollard or something like that. His family would beseech the president and say, look, it's enough. So pardon him. That's how it's gone in the past. And that particular year, the Romans had taken to a custody a notorious prisoner, Matthew 27:16, a revolutionary man whose Hebrew name is Yeshua Bar Abba. Now, from your first century toolbox, your good first century Hebraic thinkers, names are never just names. Right? A little bit in our sermon today, we'll talk about this, how it relates to the Gospel of John. But names are never just names. Things are never just things. Places are never just places. You've learned enough Hebrew to know this. Abba. What's Abba? Father, right? Abba, Father. Bar? Son. Yeshua? Jesus. So what does Yeshua Bar Abba mean? Jesus, the Son of the Father. Do you know what Jesus, the Son of the Father? I think you do, right? So, don't you think it mighty ironic that Jesus and his rival for release is Jesus, the Son of the Father? All right? There's something there. I'm going to give it to you for homework. There's something there with that. Now, I'm not saying it wasn't a real person, you know. Since I read the Hebrew and the Greek, how do the English translations translate Yeshua Bar Abba? Barabbas, that's it, Barabbas. See what the English translations do to you folks? Barabbas, by the way, means son of the father. Bar Abba. Greek won't let a person's name end in A, so it has to put an S. So Abba becomes Abbas, Bar Abbas, Barabbas. All right. So even in Barabbas, it's Son of the Father, all right? So, get Jesus, the Son of the Father. So think about that. Was he real? Yes, and all of that. But names are never just names. They are names, but they're never just names. Luke 23:19 says he was once thrown into prison for an insurrection made in the city and for murder. He was a high-profile zealot hero, was certain to draw crowd supporters, beseeching Pilate for his release. To Pilate's surprise, the first to arrive at the tribunal that morning, though, were not zealot sympathizers or sad family members. Instead, they were who? The ensemble from Caiaphas' court, asking for an immediate judgment against a certain prisoner they had brought. So Pilate probably is getting up in that morning going, man, I don't want to deal with these Jewish people. I do this every year now. I hate them. They're annoying. Them and their religion. I got to go out there, put a smile on my face and say, who do you want to release today? And they're going to beg me for this guy and that guy. And then he shows up and they're like, condemn this guy. It's like the complete reversal. They actually want him to condemn one of their own. Right? So this has even thrown Pilate for a loop. So this kind of wakes Pilate up to like, man, this is kind of interesting, right? Instead of you begging me to release somebody, you're begging me to kill somebody. What's going on here? Outside the palace, John 18:28. But they did not enter so that they would not become ritually contaminated and so they could eat the Passover. So they don't go into the court of the Gentiles and they don't go into where people have been beaten and killed and all of this stuff. The various reasons they would have seen that place as making them ceremonially impure if they entered it. So they kind of stay on the outside. Pilate told his men to grant the delegation permission to enter the palace, but they still wouldn't do so. They complained that if they did, they wouldn't be able to eat Passover that evening. Jews entering a Gentile residence would have needed to undergo a 7-day purification ritual in order to participate in the sacrifices, at least according to the halakha that those particular Jews would have had. As the Mishnah explains, quote, the dwelling places of Gentiles are unclean, and any home in which a Gentile has dwelt for more than 40 days would require a complete examination for the remains of any corpses or any other impure items. Contamination required would require the sprinkling of the water and the ashes of the red heifer. It absolutely precludes the possibility of eating the Passover sacrifice. That's from the Mishnah. In other words, it wasn't just that a Gentile home made you unclean. That's actually not true. What the Mishnah says is, basically, who knows what's happened in that place? Right? So, it's a fence. You know, they're fence builders. So, because Gentile homes, because either they're eating pork or because at a place like Pontius Pilate, people have been murdered in there. Because we don't know what goes in there, it's just best to build the fence and say you can't go in there. Okay, that's what's going on. By then, Pilate already served as Roman prefect for 4 years, so he's become accustomed to these peculiarities of these people and their irrational demands from their religion. All right, he goes out into the courtyard, he meets the delegation, and asks, well, what accusation do you have? What are you doing? So again, it had to have piqued his interest, because he actually comes out to them. Okay, this is Pilate, who billboards his name everywhere, clubs people, kind of does everything to assert, I'm the man. He's now coming out to greet them to find out what's up. So it obviously piqued his interest. The party from Caiaphas knew that they could not expect an execution order from Pilate simply on the basis that Jesus had spoken blasphemy. What would Pilate care about that? They needed to present a charge that might concern Rome, that might make Rome nervous. So they started with a broad and ambiguous condemnation. They said to Pilate, John 18:30, if this man were not an evildoer, he would not have been delivered to you. Right? So they kind of start with, look, of course he's bad. Would we have wasted our time coming here on this day and when you normally are so kind and generous to us to release one of our own? Would we actually bring one of our own to you if he weren't bad? You know, let's try that method first. Okay? So that's where we'll leave it today. We'll pick it up next week with what allegations they brought. They brought allegation not only from sedition, but they even accused him of tax evasion. Which is kind of clever, because how did our government finally stop Al Capone and his gangsters? It wasn't because they caught him murdering or anything. It's because he didn't pay his taxes. Al Capone went to jail for tax evasion. All right, so maybe they got the idea from the Gospels on that, because they try that with Jesus. Jesus, he doesn't pay his taxes, and we can't handle that, because us Jews love Rome and love paying our taxes to you, of course, right? And this guy won't do it. So they go from sedition to tax evasion to some others that we'll look at next week. All right, so let us now close with the blessing. Grace of our Lord Jesus Christ and the love of God the Father and the fellowship of the Holy Spirit be with us now and forever.